I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill, when I found you.
During your interview while you were under the influence, you told us that you liked music.
This isn't a prison, James.
This is a hospital.
Just until you recover your equilibrium.
You're still a little disoriented.
It is a very stressful thing, time travel.
You stood up very well, considering.
You connected the Army of the 12 Monkeys with a world-famous virologist and his son.
Others will take over now.
We'll be back on the surface in a matter of months.
We'll retake the planet.
This is it, James. What you've been working for.
A full pardon.
You'll be out of here in no time.
Women will want to get to know you.
I don't want your women! I want to get well!
And you will be well, James. Soon.
These people don't exist. You're not real. You can't travel back in time. Whoop, whoop. You're not here. You can't trick me. You're in my mind. I am insane. And you are my insanity.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Mechadragon, a podcast about all the geeky and nerdy stuff you love. Brought to you by Captain Geek and usually the Dark Nerd. I'm your Captain Will, a writer and a guy in Los Angeles who has worked in Hollywood both as crew on productions and in the office as a development exec of a small production company. And we also have with us today, Captain Rain.
Hey, happy to be here. Another captain, a long story, not related to 12 Monkeys, we can go into later, but comic book nerd, film fanatic, music geek. Yeah, D, all the above.
Lots of great geekiness. Yes. And we are also joined by our returning guest, Jamie. Welcome, Jamie.
Hi. I don't have a special name. I'm just Jamie. Let's see. Yeah, I went to film school. I was in Chicago for a long time working in indie films. Then went into advertising to sell you things you don't need with money you don't have. And now I just make digital tools, but I still watch a lot of movies. At one time I played music, but that's long gone. Just ask Captain Rain, not Captain Will.
I have photos. I have photos and audio recordings.
We can prove it.
Yeah.
Been to a few Comic-Cons, might have been in cosplay. There might be photos.
Yeah, so it is a panel chocked full of lots of different kinds of geekery today. And today, with our powers combined, we are
Mechadragon!
Woohoo!
Mechadragon.
Yeah, someone missed our
I noticed you were on mute during that.
Oh my
should
God.
We try it again?
Yeah, we should show you that again.
Okay.
I'm all so right. Sorry.
And today, I was picturing you doing it into the muted mic, though.
I was.
All right, and again, today, with our powers combined, we are
Mechadragon!
Woohoo!
Much better.
I like it. Okay. All right, so today we're talking about 12 Monkeys, the 1995 film directed by Terry Gilliam, starring Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, and Brad Pitt. We are reviewing the film, but in addition, we're also going to discuss its themes, storycraft, how the context of the present coronavirus moment shaped our recent viewing of the movie, and more. So, get comfy in your quarantine bunker, adjust your headphones, and join us as we nosedive down this rabbit hole. Let's begin with our non-spoilery review of the movie, which I only want to take a few minutes to do. I was thinking synopsis first, but then that would definitely be full of spoilers. So let's just quickly just take a couple minutes to rate, you know, review and rate the movie in a non-spoilery way, and then we'll move on to the synopsis of the movie and our deep dive. So, okay, so this is a movie directed by Terry Gilliam, who was the only American member of Monty Python and went on to create, you know, tons of crazy, wonderful, visually spectacular movies, such as 12 Monkeys and others. And, you know, I have to say, watching this movie, it was always one of my favorite movies, actually. And it didn't disappoint again this time. The time travel stuff is really fun. Yes, there is time travel involved. I'm pretty sure that's in the trailer for the movie, so I'm not going to consider that a spoiler. But what did you guys think? Let's start with Captain Rain, who's our newest guest.
Hey, yeah, so actually the one thing I actually didn't do too terribly of a deep dive is Terry Gilliam himself. So when you just said that he was the only American cast member of Monty Python, I was like, wait, what? And then
he's from Wisconsin, just so you know.
No, he's not.
Minneapolis. He's from Minnesota.
I was going to say, who knows? Because Wikipedia is constantly getting rewritten all the time. So we don't know. Maybe both. Maybe it's the Mandela effect. Maybe you remember him being from Wisconsin.
Effect.
But really, yeah. Now it's been changed. They changed something. But I've met a couple people from Minnesota and Minneapolis in my life, and they always are usually pretty kind of cool, creative people. So I'm not surprised that now. Learning that Terry Gilliam is from there as well. But I've also met some people from Wisconsin too, very close states for anyone who's not familiar with geography in the United States. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe it's in the cheese. I don't know.
Maybe it's in the cheese.
I don't know. Great Lakes, butter, cheese. It's dairy products. And then he went to England. All right. That has nothing to do with anything. So 12 Monkeys, I think my takeaway twofold. One was that I don't think I've ever seen 12 Monkeys all the way through.
Oh.
So it was kind of the perfect way to kind of revisit it, was because I had all these sort of like little snippets of things that I must have remembered or misremembered. So I give it two ratings. So there's one for like the diehard Terry Gilliam, Monty Python fans that love this kind of, you know, wacky post-apocalyptic genre. And it's, in my opinion, you know, home run. It's a really, really fun, weird story. You can get a lot out of it at repeat viewings. I think if you're not into this and you're into a little more basic, you know, everyday fanfare film, this might be a little too weird for you.
It is pretty intense.
It's pretty intense in moments, but you know, like with all Gilliam films, he does this really lovely kind of blend of dark commentary, social commentary, but with also like absurdist humor that sort of balances it out. So
that is a really great description of almost every single movie he's ever made.
Yeah, I mean, like if you've seen Tideland, it's a dark, like the subject matter is dark, and you don't really realize that kind of going in. You're like, oh, it's gonna be a wacky Terry Gilliam film, and you're like, oh, geez, I need therapy. But it was so beautifully done. It was so beautifully done. So yeah, so that's my encouragement and warning to viewers who have not seen any of Gilliam's work, let alone 12 Monkeys.
So how many monkeys out of 10 would you give this? I'm going to say two of the monkeys have died for easier rating.
This is great. Yeah, then definitely like 10 monkeys for sure.
10 monkeys out of 10. Wow. Jamie, yeah. What's your take on this movie?
Yeah, so I had seen the movie all the way through. It had been a very long time. I'm in line with you guys. I'm a Terry Gilliam fan, so I love the film, and watching it, there were moments where I was like, oh, this is very similar to Brazil, right? Like some of the shots and stuff like that felt very familiar. Mm-hmm. Also, I grew up in the 90s, and I love the 90s, and watching this film again, it was like, there's something about the way the actors are acting, like Brad Pitt especially, it feels very mid-90s. So I think there's also some of that. So I think like his mannerisms, actions, the way they're directing him and the way he portrayed the character felt very iconically 90s to me. And I'd never felt that watching something else, right? And I don't know why. Maybe just because that's when it came out and that's when I watched it the first time. But yeah, I give it 10 monkeys as well. I love this movie. Why
wow,
not?
That's great.
Let's go full zoo.
I would have given a full 12 had I had the two living monkeys. So.
Right. But they caught the virus.
So, yeah.
You know.
R.I.P. monkeys.
Plus, I'm not quite sure how to rate out of 12, honestly. So, you know, well, it's going to be kind of hard to top Rain's non-spoilery description of the movie. So I will simply say that I have to give it 10 monkeys out of 10, too. And honestly, so first of all, you guys are getting a podcast now from three people who absolutely love this movie. But like, just for a little further context, like, you know, all three of us are fairly, you know, critical film savvy people. And so, you know, we're not going to be afraid to point out, you know, things where maybe the movie fell short. But I have to say that this movie was so meticulously well put together.
Oh, that's a great word. That's a really great word.
It is really, I mean, Terry Gilliam, I don't know if you know anything about his like directing process when he's on set, but he is like famously or maybe infamously like obsessive about getting every little single detail on the screen correct, to the point where, I mean, I've heard stories where you know, he'll spend a whole day just trying to get like one little detail in the background right.
I was reading about that, and I guess there's like a, and I'm going to botch it, but correct me on Reddit, people. But there was apparently a scene where he spent like a whole day trying to get a hamster to run the way he wanted it to in a hamster wheel. And it was funny. I read that before I watched it, and then I completely never noticed a hamster
right
in any of the movie. So it was only after the fact, yeah.
But maybe if it was running in the wrong way, it would have been a big sore thumb, you know, visually speaking.
Yeah, true. Maybe it was because it was so well shot that it just blended into the scenery. Right.
But I mean, the point of me bringing that up is just to say that, like, this movie is so well put together that I think that it has to have a 10 for me. You know, not just because I just kind of like, you know, like it's a guilty pleasure movie for me or anything. No, it's just like an incredibly well put together.
Yeah, it's very rewatchable. Like if you're into this kind of genre of filmmaking, it's very rewatchable. And I think like as you watch it, you pick up on more of these little things. And I think this is where also Gilliam's obsessive attention to detail like comes into play. You know, you pick up on little things in rewatches, and it may not be in dialogue, but it could be in a mannerism or in the background of someplace. And
that's a really good point. I mean, I think that it is really extremely rewatchable, and, you know, in large part because it's so dense. Both the story is just, there's so much density in the storytelling, and visually it's dense. I mean, there's a lot happening.
The visuals, I mean, like any Gilliam film, but especially I think maybe from this time period, right? Because he at this point he'd probably already done Baron Munchausen, right? Yeah. Time Bandits, all that stuff. But like, and certainly Brazil. But I think when you're watching it, like for me, even just in that opening title sequence, the set or the background is so like just saturated with things to look at, and they're all doing their, like, especially when we're in the post-apocalyptic future, it's like it's very dirty, steampunky, things are moving around, and the camera lets you kind of linger on it. So it really just saturates you in, like, this is this bizarre, weird world that you're in. So whoever did set design, you know, whoever's on his team with that, it's like costume and set design, there's just all these little touches that almost kind of take on their own kind of character.
Yeah, I think it's a real credit to the entire, you know, filmmaking crew, and also Terry Gilliam, because this movie did not have an extremely high budget. It had a budget of $29.5 million, and sure, that was back in 1995, but that was still pretty low for a science fiction movie, you know, coming out of Hollywood. But yet, it made worldwide over $169 million.
Which is super weird, kind of maybe in comparison to some of other Terry Gilliam films, simply because I feel like this feels like I feel like maybe Brazil is a better film, but maybe because it didn't quite have, like, say, a Bruce Willis or a Brad Pitt in it, maybe it just didn't click with larger American audiences. I'm not sure.
Didn't it have De Niro?
It has De Niro, but I think is that the only big name that I can't remember? I should look up. But yeah, De Niro was the actor in that film.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Brazil is a little more abstract and a little bit more of like an almost like an art house film in a way.
Well, I read this thing.
So don't judge me.
Out of this.
It's a very good movie.
I know, I love it. I'm just saying, we're talking about financial success.
Yeah.
I found this quote from Gilliam about his filmmaking process. And, you know, Brazil was based on 1984. 12 Monkeys is based on a French short. I think it's 26 minutes long. And I'm going to butcher the name of it, so feel free to correct it. But the quote says, unlike his screenwriting team, who took so much inspiration from Legette, Gilliam admitted that he hadn't seen the French short before directing its pseudo-remake. And the quote from Gilliam is, if I do something based on something else, I make it a principle not to read or see the original. I'll be intimidated by it or feel an awesome sense of responsibility, so I avoid that problem. When I made Brazil, I'd never read 1984.
That's crazy to me, by the way.
Yeah, hadn't that book already been out for like 80 years by the time he would have been making it anyway? I mean, maybe 80 years is an exaggeration, but like...
I think I understand where he's coming from. And, you know, he did not write the script for 12 Monkeys either. That was written by David Webb Peoples and Janet Peoples. But so, so I guess he wouldn't have had to have seen it before he made the movie. I thought it was like, look, I don't know how to, you know, speak French either, but I thought maybe it was pronounced La Jetée. At least
I think that's
more
closer.
French to me.
I think that's a little bit, but it's all right. If French people want to correct us, that's
fine. So I'm
wrong. Bring wine.
Yeah, we'll take the correction. It's fine.
Yes. Yeah. Someone please correct us, for God's sake.
Bring bread and wine. We'll find. Yeah.
So we like the cheese.
Let's just announce quickly that this concludes our non-spoilery section of the podcast. So spoiler alert, you know, if you're concerned about spoilers from a movie from 1995, there you have it. Spoiler alert. So let's get into the details, shall we? So I'm going to quickly read a synopsis. Let's get through this quick synopsis to kind of refresh everybody's memories real quick if you haven't seen this movie in a long time, and then we'll get into the deep dive. So, James. And if you want to skip right past this synopsis, and please feel free, now would be the time to skip ahead about 10 minutes. I'll try and make these shorter in the future. James Cole is a prisoner in the underground civilization of an Earth whose population was almost wiped out by a deadly virus. While animals rule the virus-laden surface, a small number of humans huddle desperately below ground, occasionally sending up a hermetically sealed volunteer to collect samples for scientific study. After being volunteered for such duty, James distinguishes himself enough to get a more important assignment from the scientists in charge of the colony. He is sent backwards in time to gather a sample of the original virus before it mutated, so a cure can be found and used in the present. But when he's sent back to 1990, 6 years earlier than intended, he is arrested, then imprisoned in a mental institution. He meets psychiatrist Dr. Catherine Rayleigh and lunatic Jeffrey Goines. At the institution, Cole is heavily drugged and meets a delusional man who describes himself as mentally divergent before asking if Cole shares the same illness. Later, Cole tells both doctors and Jeffrey about the coming viral apocalypse. Jeffrey likes the idea, while the doctors consider him insane. After Cole explains he's come back in time to gather information about a civilization-ending viral pandemic, Jeffrey notices him looking for ways to escape, and provides him with a key and a distraction to do just that. James manages to escape confinement, but is so heavily drugged that he can't find the exit and is recaptured by force. But after they strap him to a bed in isolation, he mysteriously vanishes. Back in his home time, he awakens in similar confinement and converses with someone he can't see who keeps calling him Bob. Is it someone in the next cell? Someone monitoring him? Or is it all just in his mind? The scientists bring him in for a bizarre debrief in which they play a degraded voicemail stating the Army of the 12 Monkeys is behind the viral outbreak, and James gets another chance to go back in time, this time to the correct year, 1996, to complete his mission. He enters the time machine and is propelled backwards in time, into the trenches of World War I, where his friend Jose locates him. James is shot in the leg and finds himself catapulted through time once again. In 1996, Baltimore, Dr. Rayleigh gives a lecture about her new book, which deals with insanity and prophecies of doom. At the book signing that follows, a very creepy red-haired fan vies for her attention with his theories about human extinction. Later, as she gets into her car outside, a mugger pushes her in and coerces her to drive them to Philadelphia. But the mugger is James Cole, and Dr. Riley's pity for the man returns and intensifies. At a motel stop along their journey, Cole has a dream of a violent scene at an airport and recognizes Dr. Rayleigh as one of the people in it. She attributes it to their circumstances affecting his dreams, while Cole maintains it's the same dream he's always had and she's always been in it. He just didn't realize before now that it was her. Once they reach Philadelphia, James finds 12 Monkeys graffiti. It leads them to a rundown old theater where they're assaulted by two men. James fights them off, killing the one trying to force himself on Dr. Rayleigh. They flee, argue, and James recognizes a pet shop from the images shown to him by the scientists. He pulls in Dr. Rayleigh and coerces the people inside at gunpoint to reveal what they know about the Army of the 12 Monkeys. Among other things, they learn that the group is led by Jeffrey Goines. From there, they set off toward the Goines' home. On the way, they make a stop in the woods so Dr. Rayleigh can pull the bullet out of Cole's leg and provide some basic medical care. James locks her in the trunk of the car and heads to the Goines' home where Jeffrey's father, a famous virologist, is hosting a big fancy party. James manages to get a meeting with Jeffrey and tells him he isn't there to stop him, but he needs a sample of the pure original virus. In an escalating fit of psychosis, Jeffrey claims it was Cole's plan all along, back from their time together at the mental hospital, to steal a virus from his father and distribute it around the world. Cole takes it badly and is taken into custody by security. He escapes, running back to the car in the woods, and releases Dr. Rayleigh. She attacks him, but he breaks down while considering that the near extinction of the human race might have been his fault. After that, he rambles emotionally about how he wishes he were just insane so humanity wouldn't be almost wiped out and he could stay in this beautiful world. As a search party nears with dogs and flashlights, Dr. Rayleigh beeps the car's horn to get their attention, but when she turns around, Cole has vanished. Later, Dr. Rayleigh gives her statement to the FBI, who accuses her of having Stockholm Syndrome. Back at home, she sees a news report about the boy who was trapped in a mineshaft, but he wasn't trapped. He was hiding in a barn while he and his friends pulled a prank, just like Cole had told her before. Cole awakens in his time, the future. The scientists have granted him a pardon for his work, but now Cole is having a mental breakdown. He believes everything in his time is a delusion, like Dr. Rayleigh told him. The doctors sedate him. Back in 1996, Dr. Rayleigh confers with an old colleague about the possibility that Cole wasn't insane, based on how he knew about the boy's prank. They discuss how psychiatrists decide what's crazy and what's not, and Dr. Rayleigh says she's losing her faith. In the future, Cole is still strapped to a hospital bed. His friend is back, still calling him Bob. The voice tells him to be smart to get what he wants. In 1996, Dr. Rayleigh awakens from a nightmare when the FBI calls her to tell her the bullet she pulled from Cole's leg was fired sometime prior to 1920. She frantically searches through her book research until she finds a photo of Cole in the trenches of World War I. To her total dismay, now she believes he's been traveling through time. In the future, Cole apologizes for his outburst and says he feels better. That he knows what's real. He just wants to do his part to find the cure. In 1996, Dr. Goines receives a call from a frantic Dr. Riley, who pleads with him to protect his viral stores from Jeffrey. He reassures her and hangs up, but tells his assistant, the creepy guy who was at Dr. Rayleigh's book signing, by the way, to beef up their security just in case. In the future, the scientists make Cole memorize new information they have about the virus, its origins, and the Army of the 12 Monkeys. In 1996, Dr. Rayleigh goes back to the Philadelphia pet store. Jeffrey and his crew are inside, but ignore her. Then Cole arrives, tells her he wants to turn himself in because he is crazy and wants help. To escape the FBI tailing her, though, Dr. Rayleigh flees with him. Jeffrey leaves the pet shop with his crew to enact their master plan. Dr. Rayleigh and Cole pay for a room at a shady hotel and hide to plan next steps. A pimp busts into their room, thinking that Dr. Rayleigh is a prostitute infringing on his territory. But when he slaps her, Cole fights back in a rage, then uses the pimp's knife to cut out his own molars, just in case he's not crazy and the scientists really did put tracking devices in his teeth. They flee again, and Dr. Rayleigh calls the phone number that, in 1990, Cole claimed could be used to get a message to the scientists. When she comes back, happy that it was only a dry cleaning company and that they might be crazy after all, Cole deflates her when he's able to repeat the message back to her word for word because he's heard its reconstruction in his own time. With the cops looking for them and knowing the apocalypse is about to begin, they plan an escape to the Florida Keys. Using the pimp's wad of cash, they buy disguises, including wigs and a fake mustache, from the department store where, in the future, Cole went on his first volunteer mission for the scientists. Meanwhile, Jeffrey and his army of the 12 Monkeys kidnap his father, who finally admits to himself that Jeffrey is crazy. He tells them they'll never get the virus, that he's beefed up security and taken away his own access. And Jeffrey's crew laughs and mocks him. Cole and Dr. Rayleigh hide in an old movie theater watching Hitchcock's Vertigo while getting into their disguises. Cole realizes that, like time, the movie never changes, but his experience of it does because he has changed since he last saw it. When Dr. Rayleigh puts on her blonde wig, Cole realizes it really was always her in his dream. Traffic is heavy on their way to the airport, and the cab driver says it's because of the 12 Monkeys, who, it turns out, only set free all the zoo animals while locking Jeffrey's father in one of the cages. But when they arrive at the airport, Cole realizes he's been there before, that this is the place where his disturbing dream always happens. While Dr. Rayleigh buys their tickets, Jose finds Cole and gives him a gun. Cole's new orders are to try and stop whomever will release the virus. Cole, knowing it's impossible to change the past, realizes this part's just about following orders. Then he sees him, Dr. Goines' creepy, red-haired lab assistant. Cole chases him with the gun, but is shot by police and the FBI. We watch Cole's dream happen, this time for real, but Cole is the man who is killed. Dr. Rayleigh makes it to his side and, after he dies, sees young Cole, a child in the crowd, who doesn't yet understand what he's just seen. On the plane, the red-haired apocalypse bringer settles in and sits down next to one of the scientists from Cole's time, who mentions that she works in insurance. End of movie. Okay, so now that we've got a little reminder of the major events in the movie, let's get right into it. So, Jamie, what... Where's the question that I was going to ask? What is wrong with me?
They changed something. Oh my God, they changed something.
I totally thought you were going to say he was locked away in a menstrual institution. And... like, very
That's a different movie.
Very different.
Different film.
Very different.
But also starring Brad Pitt.
Yeah. You know, by the way, Brad Pitt was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for the Academy Awards for this movie.
Oh, wow. Boy, he did a great job.
Wow. Yeah.
So I guess on that note, you know, in the menstrual institution, what did you guys think of the performances in this movie? We could start there.
I read some places that a lot of people felt that this was Bruce Willis's best role. Mm. I think he was very good. I'm partial to other roles that he's had, but I think he does a very good job in this type of I wouldn't say every man, but when he's kind of like this like outcast character that gets kind of brought back into the fold a little bit to do his mission, I think he excels in that. I'm not really sure how many roles Brad Pitt had had, but I think this was aired in 96. It was in theaters in 96, 95. Mm-hmm. It was post Pulp Fiction. It was pre-Fifth Element. For Brad Pitt, I don't remember if this was before like things like Interview with the Vampire. And...
I think he had filmed it, but they were released after this movie.
Okay.
Or sometime during that. But yeah. All close.
Yeah, I don't think up by this time, Bruce Willis had like a non-action, non-like, you know. I mean, he had been in like Hudson Hawk, I guess. But like before this, in like Four Rooms, you know.
Yeah.
But, was he really in like a non-action type of role before this?
Pulp Fiction, depending on how you view that role. But not really. Yeah. You know, like not, I mean, we know his character in Pulp Fiction, you know, he's kind of on the run. He is still a tough guy, but I don't really contribute that to being an action film.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was in Pulp Fiction a couple years before this came out. And I feel like this was a big change for Brad Pitt as well, depending, like... He's definitely not like the heartthrob, like this like hunky male lead. He's right. You know what I mean? And I feel like this was like one of my favorite roles for Brad Pitt because it's not what he normally does. And I think he had a lot of fun with Jeffrey being this like, you know, crazy, out of his mind, weird, not just like, you know, the leading figure that teenage girls have pinned up in their bedrooms, you know? And he felt to me, it also felt like, I don't remember when Clerks came out, but the way he is dressed when he's leading the Army of the 12 Monkeys felt very Jay from Jay and Silent
Whoa,
Bob.
Oh, that's deep, Jamie. Yeah.
The long hair, the knit. Yes. Yeah. He felt very Jay, even though he's not Jay, but like there's some of that hyperactivity.
Is he, though?
He might be. He was just missing Silent Bob.
Yeah. He had a couple like spazzy long monologue riffs where you're like, now that you've put that in, I'm like, oh God, that was totally Jay from Jay and Silent Bob.
Oh my God.
I can never not see that now. Thank you.
He just didn't say Snoochie Boochies. You know, that was the only line that was missing.
He should have like released the monkeys, oops, spoiler alert, and then said Snoochie Boochie.
So when we re-edit the film, there we go.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was great, you know, and I thought I really did enjoy Bruce Willis's performance because there's this whole, you know, thing about after, you know, the beginning scenes where he's in the mental institution, he actually does begin questioning his own sanity. And I think that his performance really takes you through that process in a way that at least felt believable to me.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the scene where he, you know, he comes back and he it's after the scene at the party where he goes to accost Jeffrey Goines, and then he gets like kicked out, and mm-hmm. he comes back and he gets Madeline Stowe out of the car trunk, and you know, she likes like punching him and stuff, and then he's like, wouldn't it be great if I was crazy? And then he's like dancing and jumping in the creek.
Yep.
And he's like, I love the birds and the air.
This is one of the things I think that works about the film, right? Like, it's a time travel film, but it's mm-hmm. also, is it? Right? Like, he is questioning his sanity, and is right. he actually really in this mental hospital? Because he's crazy and he can't determine fact from fiction in his own mind. So, I mean, I lean heavily toward the time travel because it supports some of my other theories later. But
I think that it's I think that up to a certain point, the movie really keeps it an open question as to whether he really is insane, you know, or whether not. But I think that at a certain point, it does become pretty clear that the time travel is actually real.
Yeah, yeah, but towards the end of the movie, I think they really do a good job of clearing that up, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that I guess, again, I'm trying to like put on the goggles of like, I've never seen it, you know, it's what is it, you know, 2020, I'm under lockdown and I'm looking for things to watch and, you know, what would be interesting, and it's 12 Monkeys. And so I think, even though I'd maybe never seen it all the way through before up until this time, that I'd always kind of known just from reading about it and whatnot that it was a time travel movie. So that part wasn't surprising to me. But you're right. If you kind of are thinking about it as just like a straight narrative through, like there are moments where you're like, wait, what's real? What's not? Is this guy just literally like imagining these scenarios and whatnot? Like,
and I think that's part of how effective the structure of the movie is and just how well it's written, because, you know, you can look at it both ways totally legitimately at any point in the film up to, you know, around the middle or, you know, maybe getting closer to the third act when, you know, like she sees his picture from World War One and, mm-hmm. And stuff like that.
It definitely has like a way of just ramping up your own insanity as you're watching it. It kind of takes you along or like, I don't know where I'm standing anymore, because it does a really good job of sort of like setting up like a theory and then mm-hmm. questioning that thesis until you're at the end, you're like, wait, what just happened? So I think it's really kind of, again, like typical Terry Gilliam movies, it kind of takes you on this like ride where you're like, I don't know what up from down, this is crazy, what's going on, which is kind of a nice visceral feeling when you're watching a movie, again, if you're into that kind of a movie.
I think what you said is so right, because it's constantly asking questions and then, you know, maybe setting up a certain answer and then either swatting that answer aside or just calling into question everything that you thought was true up until that point. But it does that like over and over again.
And that mirror, that right, like you as the viewer, you're kind of mirroring what your characters are going through, because there's times mm-hmm. you feel like Madeline Stowe's character, you're like, no, he's crazy, you know? And yeah. then there's other times you're like, no, wait, hold on, you got to listen to him. Wait, there's some real stuff here, and, you know, put the tinfoil hat on. So I think that's always a really fun when a movie can kind of like keep you off kilter and keep you kind of questioning.
It really walks that line, I think, you know, very, very well, to where it doesn't, you know, shift too far one way or the other until the story needs it to, you know.
Yeah.
And I also loved, so Madeline Stowe, who played Dr. Riley in this movie, she did such a great job of, and obviously it's how it's written too, but I mean, she did such a great job of going from skeptical, you know, psychiatrist, woman of science to, holy shit, this man is from the future and he's, you know, given me a prophecy about the end yeah. of days.
Yeah.
And I believe it.
And I like too that, like, you know, she's disregarded once she is starting to realize this stuff. They're like, well, you basically, like, you have Stockholm syndrome. You've been kidnapped, you've been tortured, this is common, you've fallen in love with your torturer, right? Like, just get out of here. And she's dismissed. And then she's also then wanted, like she's being pursued as much as he is by mm-hmm. authorities. And that's a really interesting shift, because for that they thought she was like kidnapped, and she was
mm-hmm.
and then she fell in love with him, but she does, but not for the reasons that they are
You know, in that scene where
she's
talking to the...
You just don't understand him like I do.
Right. Well, it's like they set this up in that scene with the FBI guy where she's talking to him and he gets her to explain Stockholm Syndrome,
yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
Where it's like you begin to like have empathy for and identify with your captor. And so that's just kind of their functioning, you know, theory about what's going on after she disappears with him.
I'm going to save some of my like deep tinfoil hat film theory nerd stuff to a little bit later, but okay. I'll just give you a little teaser. I did think that whole moment of her kind of coming back after being kidnapped and being doubted, right? Now she's mm-hmm. this psychiatrist, she's a professional, she's on this, you know, quorum of doctors. So we've set up that she's saying she knows what's going on, but it mirrors sort of Bruce Willis's character's Cole's character moments when we first meet him in the beginning of the film, right? Because he's mm-hmm. being told he's crazy. He's being told that none of this is real. It's on his head. And he's just desperate to get this word out, to finish the mission because he's got to save mankind. And then sort of second half of the film, she's almost the one that's taken up that torch.
Yeah.
And almost bringing him back, right? Because he starts to doubt himself too.
Yeah. And if you go back to Terry Gilliam's filmmaking, there's a lot of parallel that adds to this like sanity, insanity conversation,
yes.
right? If you look at the board
what
of scientists.
Is yeah.
Well, yeah. If you mm-hmm. look at the board of scientists and he's in that chair and he's naked and he's lifted up the wall. And then he's in the board of psychologists and they're all lined up in the same
yes.
row and he's sitting in the chair.
Yes.
And they do a lot of very good parallel setting up the scenes so that if, again, first time viewer, you don't know it's a time travel movie, it really does lend the credence to like, is this guy sane or not? What's going on in his mind?
There are such strong themes in this movie of madness versus, you know, sanity and also power, right? Because, and those, I think those themes are intertwined because the scenes that you just described, Jamie, where he's, you know, making his case to the doctors in 1990 and then, you know, in the future, his present, where he's, you know, sitting there on display in front of the scientists that are apparently like, you know, the oligarchs of this, you know, post-apocalyptic society. In a way, they're using this concept of him, you know, and other people being insane as a way to exercise power over them and society. And actually, Dr. Riley even says in one of the scenes, it's the one where she goes to her friend who used to be the doctor at the mental institution with her in 1996, and she's telling him about, you know, she's afraid that this guy is actually correct and that there's, you know, this plague coming. And, you know, he's of course, doubtful and tells her that, you know, that's all crazy. And then what does she say? She says something like, we're the ones who decide what's sane and not,
yep.
right? Do you remember
yep.
that?
Yeah, sure. Psychiatry
reality is
new,
what we
yeah.
say it is.
Well, I thought it was really, again, sort of just echoing, if you guys, Jamie, you brought up the scene of the I'm going to call them like future scientists versus 90s scientists to kind of keep these timelines straight because it gets confusing. but if you guys noticed, again, this is like deep film nerd stuff, there are six scientists in the future sitting on that panel. In a straight row, but in the 90s, there's also six scientists sitting in a row at that panel, and he's in a chair, right? There's like visual cues that like it's mirroring, but also like what's reality, what's not? Is this just like a fever dream of someone in a mental asylum, or is this, you know, really happening to him?
Yeah,
which is just such nice, beautiful little visual touches. I also love that in the early scenes, Bruce Willis's character when he's committed. And he sort of met Brad Pitt, or I think Brad Pitt's taking him around and introducing him to like everyone in the mental asylum, which is just
yeah,
a great
funny.
Scene
so
of like
good.
Brad Pitt's. Yeah, Brad Pitt's.
He was amazing in that scene. He really was.
I heard that Terry Gilliam, that Brad Pitt smoked at the time, and Terry Gilliam took his cigarettes away to get him amped up and angsty. In addition to making him sit with psychiatrists and view like patients with schizophrenia to just
wouldn't
get that manic
me.
Energy. Mm-hmm. So like there was some theory going on in there. But getting back to that. So in that scene, the first moments where Bruce Willis is like, oh, geez, what the heck? He meets there's like a guy in a tuxedo.
Oh, yeah.
And
he
sort of sets it up. He's like, hey, like mental divergence. That's like a theme,
yeah.
right? Like I'm actually like on some planet having a battle right now. But I also realize like that could be real or that could just be a sickness. And that's like the first time where like the seed of doubt is placed in
yes.
Cole's mind. Right.
Yes, it is.
And then it's interesting. Then again, it kind of echoes back kind of third quarter of the film where I think it's 96 timeline and Madeline Stowe's Dr. Riley character is now she's written a book and it's about the Cassandra context which is a saint who had the prophecy of knowing the future, but yes. her curse was that no one would believe her. So, oh my God, it's the theme of the movie.
So if anybody's unclear on the Cassandra complex, read some ancient Greek mythology. But Cassandra basically was cursed, I think by Apollo, wasn't it, to know the future, but for no one to believe her.
I'm going to have to defer to you on that one because I did not do a deep dive on that. I did do a weird Greek and Roman deep dive on the god, the multi-faced god Janus.
Ooh.
Because, this is why I'm such a nerd, in the opening scenes when Bruce Willis is strapped to the chair up on the wall and they're talking to him,
they
but
show
it's through
him an
this
image of it, right?
Well, oh dude, now I'm gonna have to watch it again. Well, I was just looking at the sphere with all the like TVs in it, the little screens
oh,
in it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, oh, is this the multi-faced god? And then like I think and then Wikipedia, thank you. First, it reminded me of the Quintessons from the 80s Transformers movie. So that was the first trigger.
Oh
it wasn't
God.
It wasn't actually anything to do with like, you know, classic history, ancient history.
No, Transformers.
Transformers. 1980s. And I was like, wait a minute. And then I was like, oh, that's actually like, I think it's the Roman god Janus, who is, according to Wikipedia, the god of beginnings, gates, transitions, time, duality, doorways, passages, and endings. And I was like, oh, Terry Gilliam's a genius. Or not, or whoever that set person was.
Well, it would not surprise me if he intentionally embedded that symbolism into that, you know, into that scene or at any point in the movie, honestly.
Yeah, that definitely goes into the category of like, if security allowed me to get close enough to ask Terry Gilliam questions, would
yeah.
I ask that?
The man is a true artist in like every sense of the word. And he, you know, he's definitely got some eccentric processes, but my God, I love his filmmaking.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about not only the themes of free will in the movie, but the way that time travel is handled, because I think those two are intimately connected. Because we have a system of time travel featured in the movie where the way it works is if you time travel into the past, that was always part of the past.
Yes.
So as stated in the title of one of the great Lost episodes, whatever happened, happened. Right. And so there's a clue to this early on. So this is actually one of the reasons why I think the movie does lay out the evidence that the time travel is really what's happening before you even get to the end. Because she keeps saying when she first meets him in 1990, it was like, you look really familiar. And then after she, you know, has her encounter with him in 1996, she keeps thinking the same thing and says the same thing. And then she'd like finally, when she's at home recovering or whatever, she like frantically like pages through all of her like book research and finds that photo of him from World War I. But when she originally said he looked familiar, it presumably when she was already doing, you know, this research for her book, which I think it's clear that she was from that wall and everything. She had already seen that photo, but Cole hadn't even experienced that moment of his life yet.
Yeah, there were some interesting, it's funny, because I was thinking about that too, when she first mentions it, when she first meets him, I was wondering like where they were trying to take it, and mm-hmm. and initially I was like, oh, absolutely, it was at the photo, but then the end of the movie, I was like, oh, she looks around for the boy, like, why would she look around for the boy, like, what was that? Was that like because she actually did meet him? And then, of course, my brain fractured off into like, are there parallel universes? Is it like, you know,
you're talking about the very
timelines?
End of the movie? When
yeah,
she's
the
looking?
Very yeah. yeah, at the very end of the movie, like Cole and R and adult Cole,
yeah,
has not made it. Spoiler. And she's sort of like kind of saying goodbye to him and like realizing that redheaded evil scientist guy played by David Moore is getting away.
And he's great. I love
and
him.
He's great. I have a theory on his character too. It's total tinfoil hat stuff.
Love it.
but long story long, so she's kind of realizing that like not only have they kind of lost, but like, you know, Cole's dying, but then she looks around and it was like this moment where like she has to look around the airport and she sort of locks eyes with the kid, which is Cole as a kid. And it sort of kind of beautifully fed into his memories of that day probably not knowing that it was him watching himself die as an adult and remembering her as a blonde, which kind of echoed throughout the whole film. So I wasn't sure if when they were saying that she had, or she was saying that she remembered him, to your point, was that she, was it because she remembered the photo, which hadn't happened yet? Or is it because that she'd already seen him as a child? I was like, oh, that's deep. What does that mean?
Well, she wouldn't have seen him as a child, you know, prior to meeting adult Cole. And I'm pretty sure that the reason she's looking around for the kid at the very end there was because, A, you know, he had told her about this dream of his at the airport like a few times where her hair was different. And then B, once they got to the airport, Cole kind of stops for a second and he has that moment where he's like, wait, I've been here before. I was here as a kid. And then they get, you know, distracted by whatever happens next. But that moment occurred. And so I think she just kind of finally put it all together. And so she was like, holy shit, Cole as a kid must be here. And so she started looking around for him. And of course, it kind of fed into that, you know, snake eating its own tail ending of the movie.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which really blew my mind the first time I saw it, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
What I do like that they do really well is stay true to time travel. And I like a couple of things, right? Like the past is immutable. The past has already happened. Mm-hmm. You see this anywhere they do time travel. Like we can't do anything to disrupt the past. So... Mm-hmm. I like that, like, the scientists are not exact. You might end up where you need to be, but who the hell knows, right? You could, right? So that the scientists are still figuring this out. But I read something and it posed the question of, like, clearly Cole is not there to stop the virus. He can't. It's already happened, right? So is he there to make sure that it does happen? Because if you listen, the first seed that gets planted about the virus is from Cole himself to Jeffrey. This is the first time Cole brings this up. So we know that he's there to get the cure, to find the pure strain of the virus so they can cure it in the future. But it also ties into the one of the last lines of the film with the scientist that's on the plane, Jones. And the guy says, what do you do? And she says, I'm in insurance. And her whole point there is if anything happens to Goines' assistant, she knows where the virus is supposed to go. So if Goines' assistant had died at any point, she's there. She can take the virus to any of those 11, 12 cities. We should count the cities for the 12 monkeys.
Oh, were there 12 cities?
Were there 12 cities? We could go that way. But she's the insurance plan. She's there to make sure that everything follows through. The virus does happen, but they still get that pure strain so they can save. Because insurance isn't...
Oh, I didn't even think about it
that way. Oh, see, I thought she was there to get... I thought the whole thing was to get her next to evil scientist dude to get a sample. Like, I thought the whole piece was to put her in place.
But think about this. It is. It's to put her in place. But, like, what if something happens to him? She is there to make sure that the virus is spread. And if you think about insurance is, and their point of insurance is not to cover the dead. The point of insurance is to help the living. She's there to ensure that our future.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
It was dark.
I'm done for the day.
Holy shit. I was just thinking my whole life. I feel so stupid now. My whole life, that end scene, I was like, oh,
you're welcome.
Well, that scientist isn't really a scientist. And she happened to be like sitting on the same plate as the guy. Wow. Golly gee willikers. But no, your explanation makes so much more sense. So much more sense.
I didn't pick up on the fact that she was there to finish the work in case he didn't. So that was deep. But yeah, I definitely knew, like it was, and this is again like classic Gilliam like themes. Like it's dark. Like there's no saving 1995 or six. Like
5 billion people are gonna die. 5 billion. Yeah. How many? 15 billion. They're all gonna die still. There's 1% of the population.
They have to. Yeah.
Based on what you just said, though, Jamie, in that interpretation, which I think is totally correct, or at least, you know, 99% correct, my reading of it is that, like, when she says insurance, it's like, now that they know all this information that Cole was able to get, she's there to actually get the pure strain of the virus and, like, work on it, but of course not stop him from distributing it around the world, because that would be futile.
Yeah. There was also, like, playing the insurance theme, there was also a theory out there that Jose, who comes back and actually gives Bruce Willis the gun, is making sure Bruce Willis actually dies and does not live. And, you know, the questions of, like, is the gun even loaded? Who knows? Doesn't matter. The point is that he has something in his hand that causes security to kill him.
And I think that Cole even realizes that when he says to his friend, he says, this part isn't, you know, even about the virus, is it? It's about following orders.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Which is weird to me because, like, I guess, again, Terry Gilliam question, like, why does Cole have to die? I'm not entirely clear, but maybe it's just a loop and we just have to close that loop.
I think it's a loop. Yeah. I think that loop kind of highlights the circular nature of time and the immutability of everything that happens in history. So this is also kind of where it dovetails with themes of free will, right? Because if the future is written, then do we even have free will? Right? If it's not possible to change anything.
I don't think that the future is written, but the past is. So right. you the past is in the
sure,
past.
Okay.
You can't change the past. Cole's whole experience falls into predestination paradox. Like, if it's happened, it's going to happen. It's always going to happen. If it happened mm-hmm. in the past, you know, he's destined to die in that moment because that's how it's always been.
Well, I think it's interesting too, right? Is it in a way a mercy killing? Because had they let him live, within a few short weeks, he would have been watching.
He would have been infected.
He would have died anyway.
And maybe horrifically so. Maybe, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people might say like, yeah, I'll take the bullet, you know? So.
Or he lives because he was always supposed to live. But I think what you were going to say is that everybody around him dies.
Or something. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, is that not something that would also drive you insane? So is this not more of a merciful ending for that character? I mean, also, you know, hero journey and birth and resurrection and the sacrifice, you know, so very interesting stuff kind of to play with
but
there.
But poor Dr. Riley, I tell you what, she's probably going to be in jail when all this shit goes down. So.
I was wondering about that, too. Like, I mean, she's only got a couple weeks. So what does it look like? Is she in an insane asylum?
I mean, she could probably, you know what, I'm assuming she could probably, like, get out on bail and, like, make some case that, like, oh, Stockholm's syndrome, and then I don't know, like head into a bunker or something for the rest of her life.
Is she the reason why there's like a future that lives underground? Because she sort of starts that
point.
I haven't watched the TV show, but if I were to write it, that's maybe where I would have started. That, like, you
that
know, Dr.
Really
Riley saves humanity, mm-hmm. you know, Matrix style by going underground.
Yeah, you know what? We should eventually have an episode on the TV show because, you know, when they originally announced they're going to do a TV show, like, based on, you know, 12 Monkeys, I thought, but they did such a good movie. I don't know. I was real skeptical. I was very doubtful. Then I watched it. I watched the first season, and I was like, oh. That's actually pretty good. And then the second season was like, oh, that's actually better. And then, like, it just kept getting better, in my opinion.
So is it still going, or is it only two seasons?
No,
or?
It had four seasons, and it was over. So, yeah.
Did it conclude satisfactorily, or did we have a lost Game of Thrones ending?
It was definitely not a Game of Thrones, like, drop the ball.
I mean, I'll watch it.
I mean, I don't know if I would call it a perfect, like, TV ending. Like, that's really, really tough. There's only a handful of shows that have had a totally perfect ending, in my opinion. But it was pretty good.
Okay.
It was pretty darn good, yeah.
All right. Well, I've got some free time coming up.
Good.
For who knows how long, so yeah.
So before we get to, like, a couple things I want to talk about at the end, I know you guys had some things you wanted to talk about and some serious, like, tinfoil hat theories. Why don't we start with Rain? What did you want to get into?
Well, geez, I don't know. This is kind of a deep dive. I almost think it would be better if we start with Jamie's theory, because I think it'll sound a little less crazy to you and listeners. And then we'll have primed the proverbial pump for my deep dive into insanity.
We gotta grease the rails. We gotta get everybody.
Yes.
We gotta ease
everyone into the insanity. Yes.
Jamie, I'm ready for your half insane notion.
My half insane. So I was thinking about, like, you know, watching 12 Monkeys, and I was like, this is a great role. Bruce Willis does a great job. You know what other movie he was in that I loved? Was Looper. Also about time travel.
Oh, yeah.
Then I
also spoilers, he has to die in there by gunshot.
So I'm like, is this a theme? Is this a theme? Are there a bunch that we've never pieced together of time travel movies with Bruce Willis? So I was like, well, Fifth Element, not really time travel, but you've got aliens that are coming in and we're trying to stop these aliens, and possibly there's some dimensional and time shifts there that aren't necessarily 100% that his character is doing. And then Pulp Fiction, not time travel, but very non-linear. And who else do the three of us love and know that travel through space and time in a very non-linear fashion?
In a timey-wimey kind of a way, would you say?
I would definitely say timey-wimey. So I posed the question, is Bruce Willis a Time Lord?
I not only think that he is, I think he might be the Doctor based on some of that stuff.
This is true. He could be, right?
Yeah. So is Bruce Willis, I think we should grab a DNA sample, determine if he is from Gallifrey. Mm-hmm, he may not mm-hmm. even know.
We just need to take a stethoscope to both sides.
Does he have two hearts? Yeah, I think the biggest thing I think Jamie and I were seeing on Reddit was fans showing in the opening scenes of and the end scenes of 12 Monkeys when Bruce Willis is kind of going up and we realize he's kind of going through this post-apocalyptic, beautifully shot Philadelphia future, and he sees that angel.
Oh God!
Which when we find out later, yeah. We find out later that's the angel in the store in 1996 that they're buying their disguises in. And I guess it must be around Christmas time because they're setting it up. But I was like, oh my God, don't blink.
I'm going to, I sent Rain a text with a screenshot and I will send it to you now, Jess. But it literally says, do not even blink. Sorry.
Yeah.
Will.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you now.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Please send it. I'll have to share that on our Instagram or something.
It was amazing. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, he's definitely a Time Lord, if not the Doctor himself.
After he gets shot in the airport, he probably has his, you know, next regeneration.
Exactly.
You know, and turns into Christopher Eccleston or something.
Or something, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He's
yeah,
between yeah. whenever and then 20 whenever when Eccleston shows up. It's perfect.
And it's right. bad.
Because, you know, there's that
again.
Period during the Time War when we don't really count that regeneration of the War Doctor. So he could have been like, you know, War Doctor, you know, 2.0.
Right. And does post-apocalyptic Philadelphia, does it parallel post-apocalyptic Gallifrey? I mean,
he must have been on strong. A mission to get something to help win the Time War.
Exactly.
It's all obvious to me now.
It's clear. You've looked into the TARDIS and the TARDIS has looked into you. Now, everything makes sense. Everything makes sense. Yeah, what you didn't realize is when it said Bad Wolf, beware the army of the 12 monkeys. That was like what people were spray painting.
That was just off frame.
Yeah, yeah. Rose didn't quite understand. So she was just like, Bad Wolf. Yeah, okay, cool.
Bad Wolf.
Yeah, I see what you mean by letting Jamie grease the rails now.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. So if you guys are ready, there is some insanity. I'll try to keep it light, this being my first time on this show, so I don't want to freak anyone out. But again, kind of going back to film study and film nerd stuff and just the beautiful cinematography, I loved, you know, again, classic Terry Gilliam color palette of like these cool colors and definitely had a 90s feel to it and definitely has almost like an art piece or theater kind of feel to a lot of, you know, Terry's work, which was just so lovely.
I always love his cinematography. It's just, it's always so beautiful and well thought out and always serving a purpose in every scene, you know?
Yeah, just so lush and weird, but just completely it encapsulates you into the world he wants to drag you into. And then this could be completely by accident, but I just knowing how detailed Terry is, I wonder about it. But again, in the opening title sequence, we're in this kind of basement as Bruce Willis is already suited up and he's going through this like basement filled with pipes and whatnot. You see Christopher Plummer's name come up and I was like, oh, there's a bunch of pipes and Christopher Plummer and Plummer pipes. That's very funny. Also, was that a reference to Mario Brothers? No, I'm sure not. I love that it also had Frank Gorshin playing the kind of head psychiatrist in the 90s timeline because he's the Riddler from the classic Batman TV show. So shout out to TV show and the Riddler. And then also like, it was the Riddler. What does it all mean? Very deep, very, very deep. A personal connect to me in this film that kind of was a little moment like, was as they're making announcements or the first time in the opening movie, we're in what is the future/flashback of the whole kind of airport chaos scene. You hear overhead announcements from like the just airport people announcing gates. And one of them was Rome, which I thought was very interesting considering current time frame that we're in right now. And the fact that I was supposed to be in Italy and it got canceled due to potential apocalypse. So super, super interesting. Loved the little details of people in future time wear like plastic raincoats. It's almost like a underground sort of fashion thing.
Yeah.
But when Bruce comes back, I want to say the second time, and he kidnaps Madeline So's Dr. Riley character, if you notice, he's kind of dressed like a hobo, but in one of his layers of his jackets, he's wearing a plastic raincoat. So it sort of speaks that like you might not be sure if he's insane, but he's wearing something from the future.
That is another great clue, like thing to confuse the audience as to whether he's crazy or actually going through.
Right. Yeah. Super interesting. And then if we want to take is it the red pill or the blue pill? If we want to take the crazy pill, Will and Jamie, you guys know that I recently went on an insane dive of George Lucas's work with the Star Wars prequels, middle series, and current series, and kind of went on this ring theory.
Talk about a rabbit hole.
Yeah, it was a major rabbit hole. Still don't know how I feel about it. Still in it. But the minor takeaway is, you know, there's a storytelling, what is it, structure called like the ring theory. Mm-hmm. And the ring theory has some basic things. I'm going to botch it because I'm, you know, not a film student, but beginning, middle, end. Beginning should sort of mirror the ending or vice versa. The mm-hmm. ending should mirror the beginning. And the middle is usually where the character has this transformative moment or that like hero's journey arc where he or she steps into what the transition happens. And I thought it was really interesting because at the middle point of the movie, I timed it. That's the moment when Madeline Stowe's Dr. Riley character takes the bullet out of Bruce Willis's leg. And she notices that the bullet looks different. Oh. And shortly thereafter, she discovers that she is told by that FBI agent that it's from 1917. And then that's when she starts to kind of trip. And that's the moment where she starts to believe that he's real. And he starts to doubt himself. So now the characters have really literally switched positions. And he doesn't want to believe it anymore. He just wants to stay with her. Yeah. So it's this beautiful like mirroring. And of course, the film.
That's a strong midpoint.
It's a strong
really
midpoint,
is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the film mirrors, if you think about it, it opens up with the scene of the airport chaos and it ends with the scene of the airport chaos. So it does sort of mirror each other with that center point, which I thought was pretty cool. The other creepy thing is that World War I, 1917, which is that timeline that if you're kind of like, why are you thrown into this? That's kind of a weird one. It seems sort of out of context a little bit. But World War I was famous for actually in real life a real pandemic, which was the Spanish flu. So I thought that was really interesting that they really had just tied, like no thing was just there by chance. There was reasons why they were sort of having these dates and whatnot. So it was kind of creepy sitting under lockdown at the moment, kind of watching that going like, oh my God.
That's awesome. And I think that this brings up kind of where we were talking about taking this is like, okay, this movie is shot 5 years before 9/11, right? Or it comes out about 5 years before 9/11. So it exists in a pre 9/11 world and it exists in a pre coronavirus lockdown world. So if this movie were to be written 6 years later, 5 or 6 years later, post 9/11, how much of this movie would change, right? So you couldn't.
A lot.
Yeah,
maybe.
Right. Like you can't, would they be thinking about like back then? Would this doctor be able to get these vials of air, you know, take these into an airplane, right?
No way.
I love that he was sniffing them too. That was just so creepy to me, right?
So creepy. But since he's a doctor, would he have been able to write himself a note that says for medical purposes, I have to have this? And how would they have bypassed that situation to make it still happen? Right.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that when I was watching that scene. I was like, this would never happen post 9/11. Right.
Yeah.
There's no way they let him on the plane with those.
Yeah.
Although if they're not filled with liquid, maybe he does get them on, actually.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it was weird. It was, definitely. Because I remember, too, like kind of looking at it, they're like, okay, security, it's like a little metal detector.
Right.
Like, what?
But the tension in that scene is so high. At least it was for me. It's because it goes through and they're like, sure, we'd like you to open your case. And he's like, oh, me? Like he's surprised. And he opens it up. And the whole point, he like takes it out. And every step of the way, like it's just ratcheting up the tension even further. Because at this point, we as the audience know exactly what's in there and exactly what's about to happen. Right. But he opens it up and he like puts it under his nose. He's like, and it's odorless. See?
It was so disturbing. I was like, oh God, this is, oh.
This is superficial and has nothing to do with this conversation. But damn, the color that they dyed his hair red was also very creepy.
So funny you should mention that, because I was like, man, what's up with like, you know, people of color getting killed first in films and redheads being evil and like, you know, there's some movie tropes we're like leaning on here. And then fasten your seatbelts, people. I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, if we're going to go that everything is a symbol for something, which again, you know, security, please let me ask Terry Gilliam. I'm so curious. But in Norse mythology, Loki is technically a redheaded fire god of chaos. So is he not spreading chaos for change? Because certainly like the world is forever changed.
Is he the original red-haired stepchild?
Right. Yeah. take that, Kevin Feige. There you go.
But also, I didn't catch on until rewatching, or maybe I just didn't remember. It was like one of the first flashbacks that Bruce Willis has of this scene playing out. It's actually Brad Pitt carrying. He's got the red hair. Brad Pitt. And so I wonder how that all sort of ties in. And maybe it's just because, you know, he's Leland Goines' son and he assumes it's him because of the Army of the 12 Monkeys. But then it goes back to Catherine Raley's theory of like, it wasn't really me in your dream. You're just putting me there.
Right.
But then that also leads credence to the sanity question of like, well, we've seen him change the face of characters in his...
See, I thought it was that potentially that there's this almost goes into like endgame time travel theory, is that the minute you go back, you fracture and make a new timeline. So was it that he remembers Brad Pitt's character, Jeffrey Coyne's character, in some of his flashbacks because it maybe was, but maybe because he did certain things differently as he fractures and goes back to create another loop, that then it's not? I don't know.
I think these are the kind of details that definitely muddy the waters enough to make it a really, like, the more you think about the time travel problem, the more complicated it can get, right? But my reading of that ultimately is that he saw that in a dream, and so it was just his, you know, current situation of trying to figure it all out and, you know, still thinking the 12 Monkeys did it and having met Jeffrey Goines, sort of intruding onto his dream, which was actually a memory of what happened to him on that fateful day as a kid. At least that's what I'm going with right now.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing too is that, like, I think we're sort of missing the title of the movie, 12 Monkeys. Like in one hand, it's classic Terry Gilliam, Monty Python. It's like a punchline. It's like, oh, 12 Monkeys, what does it mean? Nothing kind of a thing. But yeah. I also loved, again, internet deep dive. Thank you, internet peoples, that the Army of the 12 Monkeys was sort of like a Wizard of Oz reference, where there were 12 monkeys that were getting bribed to do evil things and promised that they would be allowed to become human if they kind of carried out these missions. So it was like, wait, what? Like, and then it's like Wizard of Oz, Man Behind the Curtain, alternate realities, right? Like Dorothy sees the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and whatnot as characters that she has on the farm. You know, it's this duality of like what's real, what's not, into Oz.
Wait, did that really happen in the Wizard of Oz with the 12 monkeys?
I think it's the books.
In the books.
So I think it's from The Magic of Oz.
Okay.
There was more than one book, people.
There's several. There's several Ozma.
To be fair, I've never read any of them.
I've read a few of them, actually, but just not The Wizard of Oz, because I watched them.
I've seen the movie Wizard of Oz with Judy Garland, and I've seen bits and pieces of Oz with Fursa Balk.
Oh, Return to Oz.
Sorry, Return to Oz. Yes.
Yeah. That was kind of like adapted from like two or three of the other
books.
Very
disturbing film. That was Gilliam-esque in its own way, for sure. But yeah, apparently, according, again, internet, the Magic of Oz, in which the Gnome King and Kiki Aru convince 12 monkeys they will have an endless supply of food, if they become human soldiers for them. So were they actual Oz monkeys that were, I don't know.
That's a really interesting comparison. I'll have to look and see if, because I mean, if the original, you know, short film that it was based on was called La Gite, or however we actually pronounce it, that's not 12. I'm pretty sure that doesn't translate into 12 monkeys, right?
Oh, that's a good point. We don't
know
what it
translates
into.
So that had to have been
into
something that either Gilliam or the screenwriters did, which says to me it could certainly be a reference to The Wizard of Oz and all of that.
Sure. I mean, I think, too, it was interesting. Again, this is like more than past the halfway mark. They're in a theater, and I think it's actually towards the end, right?
Vertigo?
They're in the theater. Yes. They're watching Vertigo, and Vertigo, right, classic of like, who's Kim Novak's character? Is she this person? Is she that? Like, she's going insane. She drives, like, Jimmy Stewart's character insane. Like, there's death. There's a death in it, right? Her character. Mm-hmm. Spoiler for Vertigo. There's death in it.
By the way, if you haven't seen that one by now, it's been out long enough.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's on
Vertigo
you.
Vertigo with Jimmy Stewart. Yeah.
That's on you. The other thing I thought was super interesting is, if you haven't seen Vertigo, which I'm sure, you know, who knows at this point, hey, you got free time, kids. Check it out. I'm sure it's free on Amazon Prime. Some classic film work there, Mr. Hitchcock.
For sure.
But there's scenes in Hitchcock and Vertigo, right, where Jimmy Stewart's character is afraid of heights. And so there's those scenes where it's like a weird kind of visual spiraling to visually depict what Vertigo looks like for mm-hmm. Jimmy Stewart's character, but that sort of mirrors the opening 12 Monkeys spiraling around
oh, it really
in the credits.
Does.
So it's like, again, throwing you off kilter, what's real, what's not, you know, are you losing your mind, you know, throw in some really extreme camera angles, and then, yeah, you're like, you as the viewer also, you have no idea what's going on. If anything, maybe you or Jimmy Stewart as the audience.
Yeah, you know, at times, you know, throughout the movie, the way that it's shot, the camera angles and cinematography really does create a sense of unease and disorientation, particularly when he's at the mental institution and you have these like weird angles, like close up on people's faces and things, you know, kind of off kilter like the whole time as he's drugged and things. So I think that's a really accurate observation.
Yeah, you notice that those angles get more extreme and disorienting when later in the film, when he goes to confront Brad Pitt's Jeffrey mm-hmm. Coins mm-hmm. in his dad's house, and you're like, that whole staircase scene was like, oh, it was actually kind of making me nauseous. I was like, whoa, what's going on?
Yeah, some really great work from Gilliam and everybody involved there. So, but before we wrap up, because we are getting on in time, this has been a great conversation, but let's talk for a moment about watching this movie in the context of our current moment when the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, is sweeping across the world. So here in California, where I live and Captain Rain lives, there is currently a state of emergency and a stay-at-home order from the governor, in effect. Just about everything but grocery stores and pharmacies are closed. There's very little traffic. So, for example, 5 p.m. on Friday, the roads were essentially empty, which is super creepy.
It's like
watching a post-apocalyptic movie.
It's like 28 days later. It's bizarre.
Yeah. And we have more and more people are getting sick and dying. Mm-hmm. So here are the questions, okay? And we can just kind of go from there. How did watching 12 Monkeys, the movie, in this context change your viewing experience? Do you think the movie affected you differently than it did when you watched it before? Did you feel differently or pick up on different details? Like, what do you guys think? Jamie?
Oh, boy. I don't remember too much from the very first time I watched it other than being like, I love this movie. Honestly, it's been a very long time. Mm-hmm. There definitely are some similar themes, but I feel like right now, in a weird way, we're more isolated than they are at the beginning of the movie after the virus has taken hold. They're all underground together. Now, granted, there's only 1% of the population left, but they're all underground together, and I have questions about why underground is safe, but well, whatever. But we also, if you're by yourself, and thankfully all three of us are married and have pets and or children we consider pets.
I have
pets
a tortoise.
We consider children.
Yeah. But like we still have this like we can touch someone, we can hug someone. You know, if you live by yourself right now or you're elderly, your kids can't or probably shouldn't come and visit you. So you're missing some of these tangible effects. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways that might be a little harder and more isolated than being underground.
Although I think Cole was technically a prisoner.
He was.
So he was like lived in a cage.
He was, but he had someone in the cage next to him. Like Jose is right there next to him. And they're kind of friends. And they're probably not the kind of dudes that are going to hug it out in real life.
Probably.
But you don't know.
Right. But, you know, they have, if they wanted to put their hand on their chicken wire cages and touch each other's hands, they could, you know.
What a touching moment.
Right. And there's a weird comfort, you know, misery loves company, but you guys can all bring each other up together. So aside from the prisoner aspect, like he does have Jose there and they can commiserate and they can feel these and they can reminisce together. But if right now, if you're in your house or just your yard, you may be totally isolated. And that feels a little scarier to me.
See, that's interesting because I was thinking a little bit along the same lines, but I was thinking like, it almost kind of, you know, parallels what's going on right now because being under, I don't want to say quarantine, but it is lockdown for to not spread the current coronavirus. It feels like in a way we are in the future underground in these cells looking through these glass windows, which is our computer screens or cell phones and FaceTime even though we are connected, it's not like Matrix 2 where we're all having a rave underground and having a good time and doing shots and yo, Neo. Like we can't do that. So even, I mean, maybe Well, technically, if you have a family of 12, right, that's technically illegal. So you got to go kick two people out because that's 10 people or more. So
oh my God.
I don't know how strict
good luck,
these rules
little
Bobby,
are. Out on the street.
12 monkeys, you got to send two away because it's 10 or less. A gathering of 10 or less monkeys is fine. 12 is too many.
We established that at the beginning of this podcast. 12 is too many.
12 is too many. So what have we learned, kids? 12 is too many. 10
is
fine.
12 is too many.
Yeah, no, but it's. I mean, all kidding aside, it's pretty dark, right? Because it's sort of like, hey, we're going to see how this goes till maybe April, but also shrugs, and also we'll see right. how it goes. Like, I kind of almost feel like there's, like, weird Brazil future scientists about to, like, roll up in their dirty, you know, steampunk things to like scrub me down and put me in this like weird body condom. And I guess that's the other thing too, is that part of me, I was like, you know, Bruce Willis is like full hermetically sealed thing, his like suit. I was like, I would totally go to Trader Joe's dressed in that.
Oh my like, God, right.
Like I feel safe. I feel safe in that. Like if I'm letting my insanity kind of run wild, like that's like, sure. Do you want a mask or do you want that? I'm like, I'll take that. That looks better.
You know, that's something I thought of, and like that's one definitely a difference with watching this movie now from other times that I've seen it, because when he's putting on that whole thing, like originally when I saw the movie, I was like, oh, that's extreme, but now I'm like, I could totally, I wish I had one
where
of those.
Where did he get that? Yeah,
Naomi Campbell did it, right? Like Naomi
Campbell
did it
on Amazon, because I'll order it now. Yeah, oh, and Naomi Campbell, hands down, because not only was she getting her germaphobe bomb, but she looks fabulous. I was like, damn it.
Yeah, and it's also, can I get people to like scrub me down, you know, against the wall the way that he got really
they're
like,
in Korea sterilized. They're old women in Koreatown.
not right now. You're gonna have to wait.
Oh boy.
Well, I feel like this has also been a deep psychological study into all of our psyches. So it's like, someone should get Will a broom for his birthday.
There's no closing Pandora's box now, let me tell
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I do want to close the loop on something. So I was trying to find the cities that they deliver the virus to at the end of, and I haven't found that, even though I've seen it before. I can't find it in this moment because I wanted to count Save the 12. But going back to my Time Lord theory, there's a Bruce Willis movie I hadn't seen where he meets a younger version of himself called The Kid.
Oh, I never seen that movie, but I kind of can like sort of see the poster in my mind.
Right. And then there's a line in 12 Monkeys, and I remember.
Oh, yes. I think I know where you're going.
Yeah. He says, all I see are dead people.
You're dead people.
Yes, that's right. And then he does the Sixth Sense where he talks to dead people. Not really time travel, but still dimensional travel, which the Time Lord can do. So,
God damn it.
Oh,
okay. Also, feeding into Time Lord theories. So it's kind of Baltimore and Philadelphia. Haven't done a deep dive on the symbology of Baltimore, but I will. I can. But Baltimore Zoo is where they release all the animals, right? Mm-hmm. And that's also the place where in Unbreakable from 2000 that Bruce Willis is the janitor, and he so time travel, right? And then two in Shattered with Jamie McAvoy.
Yeah.
Brilliant performance, by the way. He's you find out at the end, big reveal, spoilers, is that he's been hanging out in the Philadelphia Zoo. So again, Time Lord, Philadelphia Zoo,
so
Time
many
Lord.
Tie-ins.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So many tie-ins.
We're on to you, Bruce Willis.
We are coming to listen to both hearts.
Yes. Yes. Take security detail off of Terry Gilliam and put it on Bruce Willis because we know he's a Time Lord.
We're coming for him, damn it.
Yeah.
But he probably already knows that.
Oh, he's probably already like done something already to prevent it. Oh, he did. We're all under lockdown. Oh my God.
And now we're back to 12 Monkeys, where Will, you can go on with your COVID-19 12 Monkeys parallel.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's dark. It's dark. It's dark
oh,
and deep,
boy.
Guys.
Well, these are dark days. I mean, for me, when I was watching the movie, there are a couple things that jumped out at me. Like one was the inability for people to believe that something like this could happen, which is on stark display in the real world right now. Like there's kids on spring break that are just like partying on the beach.
Oh yeah.
Like,
they had to shut
hundreds and hundreds.
They had
of
to
them.
Shut the Florida Keys down. Doo,
yeah.
Doo, doo, doo.
Yeah.
Because Florida, and people were like, we want to party on the beach. And I was like, but what?
But But yeah, obviously, you know, that is something that I noticed in the movie before, but it just had a different resonance with me this time around.
Sure. And yeah, it just felt we're living it
because we're living it. I mean, yeah. Other than that, you know, I guess there was just a general sense of like being more empathetic with, I don't know, the survivors or like the people that like the characters that knew what was coming. Right. Like I had this much like more urgent sense of like, you idiots, just listen to them.
Yeah.
Other than that, in sort of a general unease, you know, throughout based on, you know, my current existence. Yeah, there wasn't too much difference. I mean, I was able to appreciate the movie in all these other ways that we've talked about, but there was definitely a different layer sort of to my experience of the movie this time around, I guess.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because I kiddingly would say that, you know, especially to people who maybe hadn't seen some, you know, great cheesy 80s flicks that, you know, they should check out the documentary They Live. And, you know,
so many good ones.
Like, oh, really? It's a documentary. I'm like, yeah. John Carpenter, very strong, you know, documentarian, like completely not, you know, picking up on the riff. But now I'm just like, oh, God. Like art is imitating life. Like, you know, there are these themes. And I think, you know, previous to watching 12 Monkeys, I had also just been kind of just generally reading about pandemics in general and like reading about the Black Death and the Spanish flu and influenza.
Why wouldn't you?
Hey man, maybe I should have been, maybe I shouldn't have dropped out of my biochemistry major. Oops, sorry guys, that was on me. Could have saved y'all.
Thanks a lot, Rain.
Sorry, my bad. But yeah, so I was like reading that and then I was like watching 12 Monkeys and then, you know, kind of living out, you know, the Dr. Riley moment where I've, you know, putting all these notes up on my walls and losing my mind with like, you know, all these connections and whatnot. But yeah, it's bizarre because there's this very bizarre reality that we're living in where this can go on for longer than we know. But I think like I think it's gonna have some kind of really drastic effects. And so much so that I was wondering like, okay, well, the Spanish flu, you know, arguably about 100 years ago, like was equally as devastating. Why don't we really remember it or think about it? And the best I could kind of come up with, you know, reading some articles was that, you know, it was just sort of tied into the end of World War One, which in and of itself was such a devastating tragedy. There was so much loss of life, you know, all that stuff that it sort of just sort of swept under of like, and then all this other kind of crappy stuff happened. But like, hey, we're here.
It's on that point, actually, that I want to relate it back to the movie a little bit, because I think that it feels like it was about 100 years ago now.
That
happened. And I think that as a society, we've just gotten to this point where we feel like, oh, well, that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore. You know, we don't have to worry about it or it'll be taken care of.
And true, a lot of people aren't living anymore to be like, wash your hands.
Sure, of course.
I survived the Spanish flu.
But, you know, that's why it hit me so much in the movie. It was like that people, like, to even think that that could happen, they were like, that's insane.
Right.
And that
was
not
inconceivable.
Yeah, and it was not only the opinion of just like regular people, like the doctors that Dr. Riley had worked with, but like even Christopher Plummer's character, when she called him and like ranted about it, he was like, well, that's obviously crazy. Well, he did, you know, take a supposedly prudent step of like beefing up security measures after that. But I think that was more because he thought that his, you know, son was a little off kilter.
Oh, wait a minute.
More
wait
so
a minute.
Than...
Wait a minute. Who called Christopher?
Dr. Riley called him.
So did Dr. Riley change the timeline and that's why
it was the
David
assistant?
Moore's redheaded?
You could say that. I mean,
and not his son because he had taken precautions to...
Because he says later when Jeffrey kidnaps him and he's in the van or whatever, he was like, I didn't want to believe it before, but you're totally insane, but it's too late because I took myself out of the loop. I don't even have the code anymore. Which implies, I think, that he gave control to that assistant guy...
Which is
what allowed him to actually take it out and do everything. And that's because Dr. Riley called him panicking because Skull was sent back in time. Like all this stuff, you know.
Yeah. It's so deep. You can just, you know, definitely rewatching. You can, you know, if you want to go crazy.
That's why I say we really have to go down the rabbit hole if we want to talk about this movie in detail, because there's so many interconnected. You know, I think one of the great things this movie does is it shows how complicated causality can be. time travel or no time travel. But when you add time travel, it like gets even more complicated.
Well, and maybe Rain, Captain Rain touched on this in, when she was talking about the scene at the movie theater. But again, I'm listening, but also just trying to find the name of the cities they take the virus to. It's not that hard.
Is it 12?
I can't find it. I'm going to keep looking. But it parallels to what we're talking about right now. And when they're watching the film, when they're watching Vertigo, Bruce Willis, like, he feels like something's different this time when he's watching the movie. And he realizes the film is static and he's changed, right? And now watching this movie, the movie 12 Monkeys is the same, but we've been changed specifically by the coronavirus. So it's like, sorry. Again, like all the themes of Terry Gilliam being brilliant and Bruce Willis being a Time Lord. He concludes the movie itself as static. It's filmed. It cannot be changed, but nevertheless does. In fact, seem different because he, the viewer, has changed, which alters his perception and interpretation of the work. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. Terry Gilliam and Bruce Willis can get out of my brain.
Yeah. There's a lot of like symbology and synchronicity and kind of bizarre, you know, parallels to right now. It's strange.
It's strange.
It's really strange.
As far as the cities go, I pulled up the script actually, and I have
it. Thank you.
Okay.
So it's from Philadelphia to San Francisco, New Orleans, Rio de Janeiro, Rome, Kinshasa, Karachi, Bangkok, then Peking.
So nine. I was actually kind of hoping it would be 10 because we could get back to our own theory of 12 is too much and we need to drop it to 10.
But 10 is okay. That's very funny.
No, it is 10. It is 10 because it starts with Philadelphia.
I did count Philadelphia. Read them again.
Philadelphia, San Francisco,
two,
New Orleans,
three,
Rio de Janeiro,
four,
Rome,
five,
Kinshasa,
six,
Karachi,
seven,
Bangkok,
eight,
Peking,
nine.
That's nine.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
One, two, three.
Unless
four.
San
Francisco. Oh, I counted
Francisco.
Rio de Janeiro twice because it's on two lines. Oh. Oops.
We've got Rio and De Janeiro. It sounds
and
like
De Janeiro. Yeah, I was like San Francisco.
They sound like
script formatting.
They sound like prepackaged foods. Rio and De Janeiro.
I'm hungry.
What's a pizza?
Well, it's funny because there in the scene where Brad Pitt's character is talking to Bruce Willis's the first time they're kind of at like in bed in the room. It's like a big circle room with all the beds. There are 12 beds. I freeze framed and counted that.
Oh, and they're in a circle.
Oh, you went that far.
And they're in a circle. Yeah.
And they're in a circle. And then when Cole makes his escape for the first time out of the mental institution, it was a little hard because I didn't have an HD version. But I want to say it was 11 or 12 doctors that tackle him in the hallway. I was trying to, like, this is how insane I was going. I was like, oh, the radio station is like 10-09. Like, if I reduce it down, like, is it a coordinate? Like, what does it mean, man? I was like losing my mind.
But
like,
seriously, I would not put
stop.
It past Terry Gilliam to
I
go
know.
To that level of detail and symbology. You
same,
know, that's
same.
What he does.
Yeah, so the symbology was just blowing my mind, too, because there was we see bears and lions a lot. And I was like, what is that about? You know?
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my. Back to the Wizard of Oz.
Yep,
exactly.
Back to
well, yeah, and then when he pulls up the blanket later in the film, it's covered with bears in a winter scene. He mm-hmm. One of the samples he takes is a spider, or no, he's got a spider in his cell, I think, with him. And then when he is in the insane he eats the same spider. Yeah.
He eats the sample. Yeah. It was very interesting stuff. I'm sure, you know, if Terry Gilliam remembered, he'd be like, probably, you know, security. But after that, if he was cool, then he'd be like, yeah, you guys, you know. You missed it here.
So let's wrap up with final thoughts about 12 Monkeys here. So why don't we start with Jamie to grease the rails once again, and then go to Rain, and I'll finish up.
All right, I'm such a rail greaser. Now, again, like...
a grease rail monkey?
I'm a greasy 12 monkey, 10 monkey. No more monkeys jumping on beds. So I read this. This is a tangent. I had this book as a kid. It was my favorite. It was called Hand, Fingers, Thumbs. And it was all about monkeys. It was like hand, fingers, thumbs, dum-diddy-dum-diddy-dum-dum-dum. Monkeys on rings, rings on fingers, fingers on thumbs, dum-diddy-dum-diddy. 12, it's like monkeys here, monkeys there, 12, or many, many more monkeys, many more drums, many more monkeys drumming on drums, dum-diddy-dum-diddy-dum-dum-dum. Like, sorry, that's where my brain went when you said greasing the rails and 12 monkeys. Feel free to edit that out because it literally has nothing to do with anything.
Or does it?
I was thinking you set that to some, you know, like music box song and put it in context of the movie. Super creepy.
I was like, if I was going to remake 12 Monkeys, you definitely get to play Jeffrey Coins 100% with that. Like, what was that?
Look, and with that, I think our recast is perfect. I really love this movie. Like I said, I really love Terry Gilliam. I think the cast is fantastic. You know, it does really ironically play into what we're going through now, but I think, you know, things are very cyclical. Like, to your point, we've had the Spanish flu, we've had these other things, but the movie does, despite myself when I was talking about Sister Rose and the nun and stuff, like it does have an impact on what we're going through today and kind of give you pause. And, you know, how much are we going to have to cut back and how much of our lives are permanently changed through all of this? A lot of films talk about how we're going to be changed through synthetic life and AI and computers. But this is a very opposite scenario with this film of what happens when we actually get taken back to basics. And I feel like that's kind of where we are right now. You know, I look at my neighbors and they have their chickens and I'm like, Jesus, do I need to start up in my farming game right now? Like, do I need some crops? Right. Like just basics, like basil, tomatoes and peppers. If the trucking industry gets shut down because of this whole thing and they don't want people going through state lines, like, okay, well now we have an impact and thank God I live in the heartland, you know, right now.
Yeah, you could just have a garden out back,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, seasonal.
Whereas
land.
I live in an apartment in Los Angeles, and...
we're screwed.
I think, you know what? I think that there is a lot of fear about what could happen, and, you know, especially if you're watching movies like this, and I know for sure a lot of people right now are watching, like, Outbreak,
Contagion,
12 Monkeys. Yeah. It's, like, suggested for me in Netflix and Amazon Prime.
We're just
going to
keep,
like,
we're gonna keep that Inception scene.
Get
going.
Your algorithms under control, guys. No, but, yeah. But seriously.
Well, weren't they saying that Contagion was, like, the top stream film on, like...
It was, like, in the top...
Apple Play, or... Yeah, and I was just like... Humanity, man. These are the toilet paper hoarders that are like ruining my suggested film right now.
We have a bidet, so they can have their toilet paper.
Well, I just want to say that even though there is a lot of uncertainty and fear, it's like, look, if you follow the guidelines of what you should be doing, which is basically to stay in, this is eventually going to pass. Now, it may take, it's probably definitely going to take longer than we would wish it to, but ultimately, I'm pretty confident in saying society is going to be okay in the end, in terms of we are not going to have to live below the sewers underground in cages. We're not going to have to send Bruce Willis back in time to try and get, you know, the pure form of the virus so that our oligarchical, you know, panel of scientists can find a cure for us. It's not going to be that level of apocalypse.
You say that now.
But by the same token, is really serious. And, you know, this is not like a news show, but I just, you know, want to let everybody know out there that we hope that you're being safe and, you know, taking all precautions. And look, if you need something to pass the time, there's a pretty cool podcast right here that we have many episodes on. And we will be recording, you know, many more episodes to come.
Yes, hopefully very, very many more.
Yeah, so I think my, you know, final thoughts on the movie are basically that, if I'm talking about it in context of the present moment. But honestly, like, this movie is just so incredibly well put together, so meticulous, so visually amazing and stunning. I mean, it's not always like in your face, like spectacular, but every shot is like a painting. You know, every shot is very well composed and colored and put together, and the performances are amazing. And it has some really deep themes that you can just think about again and again and just keep going down the rabbit hole. And so,
oh, you mean like, you know, Captain? You mean Captain Rain just did?
Yes. You guys, you don't even know. There's like a notebook filled with things I haven't even mentioned. It's just insane. I'm just gonna go hang my head in shame.
No, that we love it. I mean, this is, I think this is the perfect movie to go down that type of tinfoil rabbit hole. Ooh, that's like a new term, the tinfoil rabbit hole.
Yeah, as I look over at my notebook, it says, like, and this is scrawled in insane hand. I'll take a picture and send it to you. But it says, must be naked to time travel? Terminator, underlined. What was I thinking?
Wouldn't it be great to have a crossover, like, time travel movie with, like, Bruce Willis from 12 Monkeys, Bruce Willis from Looper, the Terminator, or, like, you know, however many Terminators there are, Doctor Who / Bruce Willis.
Apparently the kid, we need the kid in there, which I guess we all have to watch now.
You know, it's funny, like, kind of the my takeaway from this whole thing is that, like, you know, boy, it echoes in an odd way so much stuff going on right now. But there's a scene in the movie, kind of this, like, weird little subplot, but it's one of the things that helps Madeline Stowe's Dr. Riley character kind of believe Bruce Willis's Cole character, of, like, the kid stuck in the well, but he sort of says offhandedly, no, he's hiding in a barn, right? But somewhere in that whole thing, like, as other stuff's going on, they sort of just mentioned it, they sprinkle it, you know, the news updates, and someone's like, oh my gosh, they're sending a monkey down with a roast beef sandwich.
A monkey.
And then and then later there's, like, footage of this little monkey in a basket with a roast beef sandwich, and they're like, I bet that monkey's gonna eat that sandwich. And it's just, like, classic Gilliam absurdity that I'm just like, you know, if anything, like, my takeaway is sort of like the optimistic nihilism. It's like, hey, you know, like, do as much as you can, like, wear your hermetically sealed couture suit as much as you can, but at some point realize that, like, you're gonna have to eat the roast beef sandwich, you know? Like, just hang out with the monkey.
I love it.
In the bucket.
Yeah, I love it when
if you don't
go ahead.
No, like, if you don't, like, you're just gonna go insane. Like, you can't live your life completely, like, in terror. So, you know,
exactly.
Just be a monkey in a bucket with a roast beef sandwich. Exactly. Because absurd.
And on that note, I would, you know, if everybody's binging Netflix these days, or, you know, whatever you're watching, highly recommend basically any movie by Terry Gilliam.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's going to have these absurd things that just make you laugh in the midst of so much craziness and darkness that it's, you know, it can really be a healthy reaction, and some really fun movies to watch, for real.
You bring a really good point, right? Like we obviously are a very biased group of people that you know, Gilliam fanatics and love these types of films. But yeah, if you were gonna recommend it to someone, what would you say? So my recommends would be, like, if you love, you know, fashion, like, ornate fashion, if you love, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race, musical theater, rock opera, Shakespeare, just anything.
Monty Python, absurdist comedy.
Yeah, but maybe you've not seen Monty Python. Yeah, exactly. Arrested Development, Curb Your Enthusiasm, like, any of these types of absurdist things and fun things, but also with this, like, lush musical theater, like, visual stylings, with a little bit of a dark edge, then I would say, you know, if you've got some free time and you're on lockdown, and hopefully you're able to watch some Terry Gilliam.
And if you want a more uplifting experience right now, which, you know, you could be forgiven for wanting that right now, The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen is one of my favorites, and a little bit lighter tone.
You think that's a lighter tone? That's interesting.
Well, it's ultimately kind of hopeful at the end, isn't it? I mean,
is it?
You guys are much nicer than I am. I guess. I don't think
it's open to interpretation.
I went a little bit in a Gilly rabbit hole of, like, things I want to watch, but I went kind of the other way, where I know it's inspired by a French film, and they do draw on that with, like, the accordion music and stuff like that in the background.
It's very French. I know where you're going.
But it made me totally want to sit down and start watching more, like, bizarre French films, and I really want to watch The City of Lost Children again. Like,
oh, that's such a good one.
Such a great film.
Delicatessen.
Yeah.
Delicatessen, City of
Although
Lost Children.
Although not, you know, the most uplifting movie.
No.
I'll say.
You could just watch either, well, for people who haven't seen Amelie, I'd say watch Amelie, and then make it a double feature, and then follow it up with The Shape of Water. Actually, let's make it a triple feature. Start with Creature from the Black Lagoon, then watch Amelie, then watch Shape of Water. And now I feel I've revealed too much about myself and my attraction to the Creature from Black Lagoon. So there you have it.
And on that note, folks,
Send help.
Thank you for wasting your time with us.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have a moment, please, you know, go to Apple Podcasts or your choice of podcast listening platform and give us a 5-star rating and or review. That really helps the show out. We really appreciate it. We've had a fun time talking about a dark, strange movie and dark, strange things. And if we can laugh about it and find some joy in life, we're hoping that you laughed along with us to ease the current state of existential dread. And
glass
maybe
half full.
Yeah, glass half full. Everybody, that's what we're going out on. So I want to thank Captain Rain and Jamie for showing up for this truly bizarre conversation about a truly bizarre movie. And looking forward to having you guys, you ladies, on the show again to talk about some more stuff.
Looking forward. This was really fun.
It was really fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Will.
All right. And with that, this is Captain Will signing out. Bye-bye, everybody.
Aye.
Oh, wait. One more thing. I forgot. I just want to let everybody know that we are on Twitter at Mecha Dragon Show. We have a group on Facebook called Mecha Dragon, which will be in the show notes under the description of this podcast. And you can also find us on Instagram at Mecha Dragon Show. If you want to email us, mechadragonshow@gmail.com. So with that, it's really time to go. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day. And you guys want to say goodbye, too?
Oh, yeah. But make it so, sir. Make it so. Aye, aye, Captain.
Bye, both captains.
I think I've seen this movie before. When I was a kid, I saw it on TV.
Don't talk.
I did see it before.
Don't, please.
Have you been here before?
Yes.
When?
But I don't...
When were you born?
I don't recognize this...
Long ago.
Where?
What's the matter?
Tell me. Madeline, tell me.
No.
Madeline, tell me.
It's just like what's happening with us.
No, I can't tell you.
Like the past. The movie never changes. It can't change, but every time you see it, it seems different because you're different. You see different things.
If you can't change anything because it's already happened, you may as well smell the flowers.
Our music is Overworld by Kevin MacLeod. From Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.